Thank you, Gilbert. Good afternoon, everyone. The wife of a successful businessman was on vacation with her husband and another couple. They were sitting out on the balcony of this lodge nestled in the Rockies, had a breathtaking view of the surrounding mountains, and it was just an ideal location to vacation. Well, there was a lot of laughter, a lot of gaiety going on during the dinner, and as they were sipping their cocktails, they talked to each other and reminisced about the vacations that they'd spent together, going to these very exotic places, and also were talking about trips that perhaps were in the offing, trips that were ahead in their lives. Suddenly, this woman burst into tears and rushed out of the balcony and back to her room. From that time on, the rest of the trip was spoiled for her because there was another uninvited guest sitting on the balcony with them that evening. In this particular case, that was guilt. Now, that may sound a little strange, but during all of the frivolity and all of the laughter, on this particular evening, she suddenly remembered her widowed mother who had worked hard all of her life and had died in poverty 15 years before. Why should I deserve such happiness, she thought, when my mother never had any at all? You know, an interesting observation of something like that happening. I actually worked, not directly, but indirectly, with a woman who worked for the same company, and I believe that this exchange happened in a seminar where we happened to be part of the same group. But she told me about an experience she had that was somewhat similar. She and her husband had saved all of their money. They were very frugal. They'd saved all of their money, and they were finally able to make a down payment on this beautiful brick house overlooking the Sound. There wasn't any furniture in the house to speak of because, like I said, they didn't spend their money on furniture. They were saving for the house itself. But she said, you know, one evening I was sitting on the beautiful thick white rug that was in the living room of that house, and I was looking out this big picture window looking out toward the Sound, and just taking in the breathtaking beauty of the sun setting on Puget Sound or behind the Olympics. And suddenly, she said, she was struck with the realization that the reason that she and her husband were able to be able to afford to live like they were living in a place like that, because her own mother died penniless, saving all of her money to enable her daughter to graduate from college, which ultimately that degree and that education qualified her, or was one of the qualifying factors for the loan that they were able to get in order to purchase this house. But because of the guilt that overcame her at that point in time, she couldn't really enjoy her new home. Now, it might sound a little far out, but with her it was a real thing. And she was telling me how that had affected her. Just that one thing on that one particular night, that one memory. In a major U.S. city, the 10-year marriage of a very attractive mother in her 30s and her professional husband ended in a divorce. If you were to read the legal briefs, the reason was stated to be mental cruelty. But they both knew the real reason was her frigidity. However, there was a much deeper reason. 2 years before her marriage to this man, she had been dating another man, was in a relationship, had become pregnant, and ended up getting an abortion. But she never told her husband about it. And she felt so guilty, and she felt so ashamed, and that only got worse as the years of her marriage continued. She was guilty and ashamed that she hadn't told him, but that she also continued to keep that information from him. She felt he had the right to know he was her husband, but since she couldn't tell him, she felt unworthy of him. And because of this feeling, she was unable to respond freely to his advances, lovingly to his advances. And this ultimately led to quarrels, which became more frequent and gradually destroyed the foundation of their marriage. You know, some of these, in a way, may seem like unusual examples, but the experts who are out there studying human behavior know that they're not unusual at all. Nobody really can quantify, no one can really put a figure to how much suffering and tragedy has been precipitated by needless feelings of guilt. Guilt, which is one of the most common and most powerful emotions and influence that influences our lives. You know, guilt can be like a burning ember that smolders for a while before anything happens. And that's something they're very careful of when we're talking about the wildfires in eastern Washington. That the embers from the burning area of the forest aren't blown somewhere beyond the fire line and unobserved gradually after a time erupt into another flame. And so that's what precipitates another forest fire, or at least the genesis of it, unless they're able to catch it in time. But that's the way guilt is as well. It has the capacity to sour our enjoyment of living. It has the capacity to cripple our social and our business lives and cause us unnecessary worry. It can be a prelude to fears, a prelude to anxieties. That can bring on chronic fatigue, among other things, and even eventually, if it's not dealt with, lead to drug addiction. People taking pharmaceutical drugs to relieve themselves of the guilt. It can cause people, and this is the extreme, of course, who hate themselves so much. They are so guilty for something that they've done in their life that they can be driven to take their own lives. A young business executive at the zenith of his career had just been promoted to be the president of the company that he was employed by, had just been promoted, and 2 days later, he took his own life. And of course, you hear that and you wonder, well, you have it all, you know. You've aspired to run a company, which he obviously had, and he'd done very well at that. And then he's finally recognized with a title, and all of a sudden his life caves in. In this particular case, it said the psychiatrist that had been treating him, apparently for a number of years, said that he suffered from a deep depression that had started and stemmed back to the time when he left home to take his, quote, dream job with this particular company. I don't know exactly what it was, but it was something he always had wanted to do. And he felt this would be the stepping stone or a good start for the career he aspired to. Unfortunately, his father had been very ill at this time, and the rest of the family had pleaded with him to stay. It's not like there was a family business there that that he would have been involved in, that he's trying to run a family business or something of that nature. It just was that they wanted him to stay, I guess, for moral support. But he left anyway, and 2 months later, his father died. The psychiatrist said that since that time, he felt intense guilt. He felt responsible for his father's death. And even though that wasn't realistic, at the height of his career, he felt totally worthless and undeserving of what he had achieved, and took his own life. So we see and we know and we understand that guilt can be very damaging. In Genesis 8, verse 13, Cain said unto the Lord, "My punishment is greater than I can bear." And this, of course, is where, you know, God sought him out and asked him, "Where is your brother?" And ended up, you know, telling him, "Well, yeah, I know where he is. You killed him. And because of that, this is going to happen in your life." And so Cain had an enormous amount of guilt associated with what he'd done. And he said, "You know, I don't know if I can handle this. It's greater than I'm able to bear." Turn to another example in Genesis. Genesis 42 and verse 21. And the story leading up to this, Genesis 42 and verse 21, is the account where the famine began in the land of Egypt and everywhere else. And so his brothers came up to get grain, to buy grain for the family. And, of course, you know the story. He sent them back with the grain, but also with the money that they had given him for the grain. And so after a period of time, and that had been exhausted, his father asked them to come again. And so they did. And of course, this time, the same scenario transpired, only that Joseph said, well, you know, you say that you've got an old man, and the reason he can't come, your father, he's just too old to travel. And you also told me you've got a younger brother. Well, you know, what reason do I have to believe you, to test the veracity of your statements? He said, I'll tell you what. If you want any more grain, you're not going to buy it here unless you bring your younger brother with me. And of course, now, in verse 21, they said one to another, we are verily guilty concerning our brother. And they were talking about Joseph in this case. So years after they'd sold Joseph into slavery, put him in a pit and sold him, years later, that guilt weighed on them. And they associated with the things that were happening to them when they came down to Egypt, and the things with the grain and the money, and now his younger brother being asked, or the Joseph asking to bring the younger brother. He said, we're verily guilty concerning our brother, and that we saw the anguish of his soul when he besought us, and we turned our back on him. We would not hear. Therefore, this is the reason that this distress has come upon us. So guilt, if it's not dealt with, can resurface years after the thing that brought the guilt occurs. So, you know, that guilt never goes away unless it's dealt with. And finally, turn to Matthew 27 and verse 3. Matthew 27, verse 3. Then Judas, which had betrayed him, when he saw that he was condemned, repented himself and brought again the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders. So when Judas awoke up to what actually was happening, he didn't realize what and how Christ was going to be affected by this. He must not have thought it through, but he finally repented and brought the money back in verse 4, saying, I've sinned and I've betrayed the innocent blood. This man did nothing wrong. There's nothing that he did wrong. And they said, well, what is that to us? That's your problem. You deal with it. We had a deal. We came up with the 30 pieces of silver that you'd requested. If you've got another problem with that, that's up to you. See thou to that. You take care of it. Verse 5, and he cast down the pieces of silver in the temple and departed and went and hanged himself. So that was the ultimate end result of the guilt associated with what he'd done. Well, we've looked at several negative examples of guilt, but there can be a positive side or a positive slant to guilt if you look at it correctly. In Psalm 119, verse 71, Psalm 119, verse 71, it says, it's good for me that I've been afflicted. And the reason being, that I might learn thy statutes. You know, as much as we might not admit it, some of our greatest changes, some of the advances in this walk, in this road of conversion, some of those biggest changes have often followed some of our biggest mistakes, some of our biggest sins. Because the affliction has been so great and so severe, and you're tired of lying awake at night, unable to sleep because of the turmoil that's boiling through your brain because of what you did and how it affected you and how it affected those around you. And night after night, you go through this type of thing. So at some point, you wake up to the fact that, you know, that affliction has been so severe, I don't want to go through that again. I'm never going there enough. I really learned my lesson. So in that regard, being afflicted can have a beneficial effect, but it's not an easy way to do it. Well, what are some of the things we feel guilty about? Well, you name it, you can just pull out about anything. Children. You can feel guilty that, you know, runs the gamut from maybe not spending enough time with them. Being gone, being away, finding reasons to not be there to help them with their homework. Or, on the other hand, conversely, as they get older, they get to be teenagers, and they're thinking about going into a certain field, or they want a certain career. And, of course, a lot of times they get drawn away by, say, if they're interested in theater or something like that, they get drawn away by Hollywood and what it appears to offer. Or maybe your son wants to be a drummer in a rock band. Rather than encouraging them to do something that they may really have an aptitude for, but you know deep down, professionally, it's a very, very remote chance of them ever getting a job. But wouldn't you rather be a parent that they're never adverse to coming home to and feeling the love and warmth of that home rather than someone says, you know, if you do that, you're making a big mistake. And sending them out with that kind of a attitude. I mean, sometimes we have to do that with our children. But wouldn't you in the end rather have a warm relationship? Maybe they go out and they stub their toe. Maybe after a year in Los Angeles or 2 years, they find out it's not all that it's cracked up to be. But they've learned that independently on their own. Or maybe they take a job that appears to be very, very attractive for whatever reason. Maybe they feel there's a great potential there. And yet, you know that's kind of a dead end. But it's better that they determine that themselves rather than have you trying to beat them over the head. In the long run, it's better they learn that lesson themselves. What about stealing? Stealing time from our employer. You know, does the hour stretch, the lunch hour stretch to an hour and 15 minutes or an hour and a half? Or does the coffee break stretched from 15 minutes to 30 minutes. Of course, there are companies where you're on a time clock, and that's calculated a little differently. But there are a lot of companies where it's kind of an honor system. But do you abuse that? If you were to calculate all of that time that belonged to the company, and yet you, in effect, used it for your own use, well, that's stealing. What about shading figures on a person's income tax? Not paying your tithe. Of course, that's a big one. I mean, they're all big. You're stealing from God. I found out when my children got older, they told me about some things that they stole when they were growing up. My dad lived right across the road from us, and of course, they were over visiting him all the time. And I probably mentioned this before, but they told me they stole these little bags of Bull Durham cigarette tobacco. He used to roll his own. And I don't know what they did with them. They dumped them out anyway. He never ever was able to smoke the ones that they stole. And that would have been probably all right, the end result, if he'd quit smoking, but he didn't. But along with this, and Dad never told me anything about this. I learned it from my children when they were adults. You know, you sit around kibitz about all the things you get away with as a kid. But one day, and I don't know exactly what triggered this, what caused them to do it, they took a bottle of ketchup and they opened up the sheets on his bed and they liberally emptied that bottle of ketchup down in the lower part of the bed, and then they put the covers back on. Can you imagine coming home after a hard day's work, really tired, and sometimes so tired you don't even eat, just wanting to drop in the bed? Now, Dad worked, had a tire shop, and he was working with these big truck tires, and tractor tires are not only extremely heavy, but very, very awkward to deal with. It was very physically demanding. And I can just imagine him coming home whenever this happened and sliding into bed, thinking it's going to have a restful, peaceful sleep, and feeling that slimy substance down at the foot of the bed. And at first, not knowing what it was, and then I guess he finally realized when he felt it, looked at it, smelled it, that it was ketchup. I never did hear from my kids if he did anything with regard to that, since, like I said, I didn't find out until years later. So I don't know what he did, but I imagine he must have put the fear in them, because there weren't any encores of that particular performance. What about lies? Bearing false witness. Are we ever guilty about something like that? Shading the truth, not telling every part of it, holding back some, just enough so whatever you're trying to do is acceptable. I owned a 1968 Ford Cortina, which I bought new, and I had innumerable problems with that car. Right off the bat, probably only 2 or 3 weeks after I got out of the showroom, I hit a dare head on outside of Monroe. standing right in the middle of the road, and the oncoming lights blinded me until I was probably 20 feet from him, and I saw him standing there. I didn't have a chance to do anything other than take my foot off the brake. I didn't even have a chance to brake, and I whacked. It's all this stuff splattering all over the windshield. Anyway, it wiped out him, wiped out the front of the car, and I think the cost of the car was around $2,000 at that time, and it cost $1,000, which the insurance company paid to fix it, put it back together. I don't know if that had anything to do with it, but I had a number of problems with it after that, and I finally decided, you know, I'm going to get rid of this when I learned from the mechanic at the dealership that it needed a major transmission repair. So I took it to the used car part of the dealership, which was separate, a separate building. I mean, they were all owned by the same person, but they had the new car area, they had the used car area, and then the service department in between. So I just took the car over and I said, you know, what's this worth? And so they went out and gave it a test drive, and he came back and he offered me, made me an offer. I was hoping that while they drove it, the transmission problem would become apparent, but it didn't. Transmission worked perfectly. He gave me the offer, and I thought, great, but all of a sudden, I had this still, small voice in my head telling me, you know, you didn't tell him about the transmission. Now, I was trying to justify myself, I'm sure, because of some other things that had happened with the dealership earlier on. But my conscience finally prevailed, and I told the sales manager about the transmission and my guilty conscience as well. And this is kind of what Dan was talking about, how the Holy Spirit will work in our lives, that will influence, that will put thoughts in our mind, will give us ideas, instructions, corrections. So I ended up, although I ended up paying more in the long run because of the transmission, I felt good about the whole thing. To me, it was a clean slate. He knew, he dealt with it. And the interesting thing was, since the cost of the transmission was about half what it would have been, since he was, you know, getting it through the company, it cost me a correspondingly smaller amount as well. What if I was just, you know, a person walking on the street out here and God's Holy Spirit hadn't been there to influence me? I would have thought, hey, I got away with something. I got $400 more because they didn't notice that. Boy, that was really a smart business deal. That's not the way it is. It could have turned out very differently if I'd had that approach and had that attitude. And to this day, I'm sure I'd still be feeling the guilt of it and associated with what I'd done. What about guilt over sex? When I was a freshman at Ambassador College, I was one of a number of married students. I think there are about 8 or 9 couples. And so we kind of kept together and got acquainted because some of us had children, this type of thing. One day I happened to notice that one of the students, married students, was no longer around. And I didn't see him for a while, and I finally, thinking that maybe he had gone back to help with his family business or something, found out from a close friend of mine there that he'd been expelled for having an affair with a freshman girl. You know, at the time, I was very, very shocked. But over the years, nothing really shocks me anymore. You know, because, you know, when God states he calls the weak of the world, that is true. You know, it's not meant to justify sexual sins. It's not meant to justify any sins. It just means that we need to be sure we don't kid ourselves. You know, if you want to avoid a real guilt trip, then stay clear. The flirty, seeming innocuous banner that may seem innocent may be transmitting subliminal messages that can produce consequences you will regret the rest of your life. I.e. STD, HIV, abortion, pregnancy, this type of thing, and a host of others. Turn to 2 Samuel 11. 2 Samuel 11, which touches on this and a number of other things as well. 2 Samuel 11, verse 2. Well-known story, David and Bathsheba. So you know, when I say that, you know everything that happened. But I'd like you to look at a couple of things as we go through this. And it came to pass in an evening tide that David arose from off his bed and walked upon the roof of the king's house. And from the roof he saw a woman washing herself. And the woman was very beautiful to look upon. So he was watching her as she washed herself. He was watching every curve in her body. He coveted her because in verse 4 it said, "And David sent messengers and took her." He stole her. It says he took her. And she came in unto him, and he lay with her and commits another sin, adultery. Now, there's nothing that you're told about the background of Bathsheba. But say, for example, that the man she was married to, Uriah, was the only man that she'd ever known in her life, her husband. How do you think she felt after she went back home? The guilt associated with what had happened, the way it weighed on her mind. Here her husband's out fighting for the country, a serviceman. And this happens repeatedly. Unfortunately, it's too bad, but you hear about it all the time. Someone getting a Dear John letter because something like this has happened. Going on with the story, verse 5. And the woman conceived and sent and told David and said, "I am with child." Didn't plan on this. Husband away. And so David starts backpedaling. How am I going to deal with this? What am I going to do to cover up my sin? I don't want people to know I'm the king. And one thing about the king that in this particular instance, you might think, well, how does a woman say no to a king? Power is a powerful aphrodisiac. Powerful men are very attractive. You take Donald Trump and you look at the statistics and the figures look at his popularity, and yet some of the things he does and says seem really crass. But there's an attraction there because of the fact he doesn't mince any words. He's strong. He's a strong person, a strong leader. He's not afraid to, you know, say what he feels. And people like that contrasting it to the current administration. Anyway, so this has all happened. And David, trying to think of a way to get out of all those, so he said, I'll send for Uriah and have him come, presumably to ask him about the battle, the war, how the troops are, et cetera, et cetera. And then I'll get him to go down to his house and sleep with his wife, and problem solved. So when Uriah was come down, verse 7, unto him, David demanded of him how Joab did, and how the people did, and how the war prospered. Feigning interest in all these things, which he had no interest in, maybe a small interest. But his requesting Uriah to come there was with the ulterior motive of getting him to go down and sleep with his wife, so the child would appear to be Uriah's. And in verse 8, and David said to Uriah, well, you're home from battle. Why don't you go down to your house and wash your feet? Take a bath, relax, have a good night's rest. But Uriah fooled him. Verse 9, but Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of his lord and went not down to his house. So he was a very strong man. He was a loyal man. He wasn't going to be at home enjoying the comfort of his wife when all of the other soldiers, all of his other buddies were sleeping out in the trenches. That wasn't the kind of person he was. And so when David asked him why he didn't go home, in verse 11 he said, his response to David, Uriah said unto David, the ark and Israel and Judah abide in tents, and my lord Joab, the general, my boss, and the servants of my lord, they're all encamped in the open fields. And if that's the case, what right do I have? Shall I then go into my house to eat and drink and to lie with my wife? As thou livest and thy soul, I won't do it. I will not do this thing. So anyway, David is really upset now and trying to figure out what to do. So he asks him to stay another day. In verse 13, he tries something else. And when David had called him, he did eat and drink before him and made him drunk. He figured if he drank enough, he'd be drunk and would forget about, lose his inhibitions and his ideals and go down and spend the night with his house. And that evening, he went out to lie on his bed with the servants as of his lord, but went not down to his house. So Uriah was a very strong, principled man. And finally, verse 15, David is really pulling out all stops. He wrote in the letter to the general, to Joab, saying, set you, Uriah, in the forefront of him, forefront of the hottest battle, and retire you from him, that he may be smitten and died. So here's someone else that gets drawn into this web. Joab becomes an accomplice. This is out and out murder. It's not like the Navy SEALs. Their motto is no man left behind, either dead or alive. They bring him back. There wasn't this kind of thing going on here at all. Verse 16, and it came to pass when Joab observed the city that he assigned Uriah unto a place where he knew that valiant soldiers or valiant men were. And then the soldiers who had been instructed to do so withdrew. And so this web and this net expands. You see, this one little thing that started with a look is now turned into a wholesale murder and involved a number of other people. Verse 17, and the men of the city went out and fought with Joab and there fell some of the people of the servants of David. And Uriah the Hittite died also. And the shooters, verse 24, shot from off the well upon thy servants. And this is the messenger bringing this information back to David. And some of the king's servants be dead, and thy servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also. Verse 25, then David said unto the messenger, thus shall you say unto Joab, don't let this thing displease you, what happened to Uriah, for the sword devoureth one as well as the other. You know, there are going to be a certain number of people killed in battle, so don't be concerned about this. Make thy battle more strong against the city, and overthrow and encourage thou him. So he was trying to get the messenger to encourage Joab. Verse 26, and when the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, she mourned for her husband. And of course she would, aside from this isolated thing that had happened in her life. Would that suddenly take away the love that she had had for him as her husband for I don't know how long? She mourned for her husband, and what's left unsaid here, but you know by implication, what about Uriah's parents, his brothers and his sisters and relatives? So this one look has drawn into this big web many, many people, and many, many people are suffering as a result of that one look. Verse 27. And when the morning was past, mourning for Uriah was past, David sent and fetched her to his house, and she became his wife and bare him a son. But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. God understood this. He knew what was happening. And it said, you know, he wasn't pleased at all with that. And as a result, in chapter 12, verse 18, you don't have to turn there, the end result, it came to pass on the seventh day that the child died. Came down with some kind of an illness. So a large number of people were hurt in this very duplicitous charade of David. And yet, if you turn to Psalm 51 and you read the whole chapter, but I want you to just single out one specific verse, Psalm 51, verse 4. Against thee, thee only have I sinned and done this evil in thy sight, that thou mightest be justified when thou speakest and be clear when thou judgest. You know, when we sin, we've seen how those sins affect other people because of the ripple effect. However, our guilt should only be felt toward God because it is his righteous law which we've violated, and since that is the case, he's the only one who can forgive us. We need to make sure we don't let guilt ruin our lives. We need to repent of the sin that has created the guilt. And then when we ask for our Father's forgiveness, also ask him to remove the guilt from our life as well. Don't let guilt ruin your life. You know the steps you need to take to eliminate it. So be sure to do your part and then let it go.